This is Ozarks at Large for Monday, March 3rd, 2014. I'm Kyle Kellums. Antoinette Grajeda will join me in just a moment. Walton Arts Center presents the Soweto Choir on March 6th as part of the 10x10 Art Series. The 24-member choir from South Africa won an Oscar for their song Baba Yetu, Our Father, from the movie WALL-E. Tickets and more information are available at waltonartcenter.org or 443-5600. Ahead on this edition of Ozarks, several Arkansas towns have been identified by the University of Arkansas to participate in a sustainability report card program. Antoinette will talk with Michelle Halsall, Managing Director of the Applied Sustainability Center at the U of A, to talk about that program. Plus, the concept of Southern art history, how we talk about it, depends on how we define it. And this week's edition of Arkansongs remembers how Dick Powell from the Arkansas Ozarks became one of the biggest stars of his day. First, most of the region has been at a standstill today after a mix of sleet, snow, ice, thunder, and lightning covered the area yesterday and last night. Schools, universities, city offices, and courts either delayed or canceled activities scheduled for today. The precipitation that fell for most of yesterday didn't go anywhere after near-record low temperatures were recorded overnight. The low temperature for Fayetteville early this morning was 3, while it dropped to just 1 above zero in Rogers this morning. And Fort Smith Regional Airport recorded a low of 5. Tahlequah, Oklahoma, also recorded a low of 5 this morning. Urban agriculture may get a leg up this week in Fayetteville. If the city council meets tomorrow night, aldermen will discuss a proposed urban agriculture ordinance, which would alter the city's unified development code. The changes would allow residents to have on-site sales of home-produced agricultural products, and the ordinance would also allow for chickens and goats to be kept within the city. Peter Nierengarten is the Director of Sustainability and Strategic Planning for the City of Fayetteville.
The focus or the overarching goal is to promote more agriculture where appropriate and as appropriate inside our city limits, with an overall goal of increasing citizens' access to healthy local foods, with a goal of helping to address some of the food insecurity issues that we have here in Fayetteville and in Northwest Arkansas, to really support our local economy with a focus on more locally produced food, to help connect citizens to their food and create greater awareness of the benefits of local and healthy food, and to improve citizens' ability, of course, to sell and grow and produce their own food, you know, in an effort to achieve all of those end goals.
Under the proposed changes, residents would be allowed to have a maximum of between 6 and 20 female chickens and ducks, up to 3 goats, and up to 4 beehives, depending on the size of the lot on which the animals are to be kept. In addition, animals won't be allowed in subdivisions that already have rules banning farm animals. And by opening city code to allow for more animals to be kept in the city's animal control ordinance will also be similarly changed.
Parallel to this ordinance change, there's some changes to the Chapter 92, which regulates how animal control deals with animals at large in the city. So we're making some tweaks there to allow them the flexibility to deal with any farm animals that may get out, and then the ability to also, you know, take those animals in and then, you know, take payment from the owner in exchange for returning that animal to them, which is what we do for dogs and cats right now.
The Fayetteville City Council is scheduled to meet at 6 o'clock tomorrow evening at the Fayetteville City Administration Building. A federal trial originally scheduled to begin today for former Arkansas Treasurer Martha Shaffner will now begin tomorrow because of icy conditions across the state. The former treasurer faces extortion and bribery charges for allegedly taking $36,000 from a bond broker in exchange for steering state investment business to that person's company. Gwen Moritz with Arkansas Business has been covering the court hearings leading up to the trial.
It's going to take a little while for them to seat a jury. This is a highly publicized case, and so there'll be a careful jury selection. Then they'll try the case, and the case, of course, is a complicated one to try, because I think that the fact that Martha Shaffner admitted taking money from the broker, the one that has not been officially identified, although we have confirmed that it was Steele Stevens, she acknowledged in open court that she had taken money from him. The quibble is over whether this was a bribe, whether in exchange for this money she actually directed state business to this broker. So the fact that she made some admissions like that in open court can be used against her and are going to complicate her defense on that.
Last week, U.S. District Judge Leon Holmes turned down a request by Schaffner to throw out the 14 counts of extortion and bribery. Last month, prosecutors added 10 wire fraud counts against Schaffner, accusing her of misspending nearly $10,000 from her campaign account. Those charges will be heard in a separate trial. The process to reserve tickets for the talk by Maya Angelou at the Fayetteville Public Library will now begin Wednesday because of yesterday's winter storm. Originally, the reservation process was to begin today, but the library staff decided to delay the ticketing until they could be confident the library would be able to be open. Tickets will be available beginning Wednesday at the library's website, faylib.org. People needing assistance can call 856-7000. Maya Angelou will be at the library on Friday, April 11th at 7 p.m. The Arkansas women's basketball team will open up play in the SEC tournament Wednesday night at 8:30 as the number 11 seed. Arkansas will meet the number 14 seed, Mississippi, in the first round game in suburban Atlanta. The winner of the Arkansas-Mississippi game plays the sixth seed, Auburn, Thursday night. Yesterday, Arkansas ended its regular season with a 72-70 win over Missouri in Bud Walton Arena. Today's Razorback baseball game is off, not surprisingly. The Razorbacks were scheduled to play IPFW, but the game was canceled because of the wintry conditions. Arkansas next travels to Berkeley, California this week to play four games in 3 days, beginning with an afternoon contest against San Francisco University Friday afternoon. And the Razorback men's track and field team won the SEC indoor title this weekend in College Station, Texas. The women's team finished third at the conference meet. Both teams will compete in the National Indoor Championships in Albuquerque later this month. Temperatures should remain cold through tonight, lows between 11 and 17 throughout the listening area. There will be a few clouds tonight as well. Tomorrow, sunny, highs in the lower 40s. Tuesday night, the forecast includes partly cloudy conditions and lows in the lower to mid-20s.
This is Ozarks at Large. The Applied Sustainability Center of the Sam M. Walton College of Business at the University of Arkansas is continuing work with its Sustainable Energy Scorecards and Education for Municipalities program. It was recently announced that Bryant, Eureka Springs, Hot Springs, Monticello, Mountain Home, Rogers, and Russellville have been selected to participate in the second year of the program. Late last week, Michelle Halsell, Managing Director of the Applied Sustainability Center, stopped by Studio 123 to talk about the program.
This program is aimed at cities, and the goal of the program is to help local leaders better understand energy use in their community and the impact that that has on the local economy. The program has four main elements. The first element is the energy scorecard. So we work with the local utilities and we get energy data. We know every single kilowatt hour sold in these cities and every cubic foot of natural gas sold. We'll usually get a five-year baseline. And we'll break that down by the commercial and industrial sector, the residential sector, and the public sector. So things like your city hall, your police station, your public schools. And then we use this information to help city leaders see how energy intensive their city is and what the opportunity is for energy efficiency. So how much money could be saved, how much energy could be saved, how many jobs might be created in the energy efficiency sector. We bring the mayors. The second component is to bring the mayors and their and other local leaders to Fayetteville for a two-day Summer Energy Academy, where we not only share their scorecards with them, but we also bring in a whole variety of guest speakers to talk about the tools and resources that are available to the cities to reduce energy consumption. So that's a wonderful two-day event. Then we also have monthly webinars with the cities. So we'll invite guest speakers to talk to them about different topics. Last year, we invited Kansas City to talk about solar operating leases and how they're using solar operating leases to put solar panels on 80 buildings in the city of Kansas City. So we'll introduce things like that. And then finally, we make visits to those cities, to the participating cities. We will make a presentation to the Chamber of Commerce or to the public at large. We'll share the city's scorecard. We'll share information about what businesses can do, what homeowners can do, what the school district can do, and really try to help build support for what the mayor and the city council might be trying to do around this. You want the public to understand it, and so if the mayor says, we think that we'd like to adopt stronger building codes in our community, for example, you want the public to say, well, yeah, we understand why you would want to do that. You know, you're trying to reduce energy consumption across the entire city. So
after the first year of the program, what have you learned and how has that affected how mm-hmm. you're going to approach the second year of the program?
It takes a longer time to get things done than you might expect, right? The first few months of each year, we have to go out and collect data, right? We have to get the data from the utilities. We have to build the scorecards. We give the scorecards to the cities in June, halfway through the year. They only have another 6 months to figure out what are we going to do with this information. And it takes a while to go back to your city and introduce a new ordinance or, build support for that. And then, of course, once you do that, it takes a while to implement it and to start to see the results in terms of energy savings. I think one thing that we learned last year that was really powerful is that the cities can teach each other a lot. So policy sharing was a big aspect that we didn't anticipate in the first year. But when Fayetteville said, well, we have a no idling ordinance, the other cities said, oh, can you share that with us? We might like to adopt one of those. Or, one of the other cities had a complete streets ordinance. And the other cities said, hey, we could adopt a complete streets ordinance. So instead of each city reinventing the wheel, they can borrow the wheel from someone else who's already, accomplished that. So policy sharing was a huge bonus that we really didn't anticipate.
And you've just selected 7 more cities for mm-hmm. the second year of the program. Can you tell me a little bit about how you select the cities? Is this something that they apply for?
Cities do apply for this program, and we are looking to have some diversity in our cities. So we want cities of all sizes. We want small cities and large cities. We want cities that represent different regions of Arkansas. We don't just want this to be cities in central Arkansas or clustered in northwest Arkansas. So we try to reach out and get cities of different sizes across the state, and we want cities that have different utility types, so investor-owned utilities, co-ops, or municipal utilities. So those are some of the things that we're trying to achieve when we select those cities. But I think the most important factor is the enthusiasm of the local leadership. So if you have a mayor that really gets it and says, yes, we need to use less energy, we need to be better stewards of our energy resources. We need to try to create jobs in this area. You are far ahead of the curve. So we're really looking for enthusiastic local leaders.
The initial funding, where did mm-hmm. that come from and how long is it good for?
The initial funding came from the Arkansas Community Foundation. It's a 2-year grant. So we have enough funding to work with last year's cities and this year's cities through the end of 2014. And, of course, we're seeking funding right now so that we can continue working with cities in 2015.
Okay, so still working on funding. Nothing mm-hmm. set yet. Okay, perfect.
Of course.
But plans to hopefully get funding so you can continue the program because it seems like it's been successful?
I think it's been successful. In terms of raising awareness, in terms of raising energy literacy levels, and helping public officials to understand the impact that energy has on their local economy, I think that's invaluable. So just building a cohort of leaders around the state that, you know, bring energy into their strategic thinking about their city and its future. They think about public safety. Right? They think about sewer systems. They think about trash pickup. They think about street repair. Energy has to be a part of it. They just can't say, okay, well, the utilities take care of that. I go to the light switch, I turn it on. Or if there's a storm, the utility company will go out and fix the power lines. There is a definite role for cities to play in making their cities less energy intensive, and to have adequate power supplies for the future, to meet future needs for the growth of the community. I mean, just so many reasons why mayors and city councils should pay attention to energy.
Well, Michelle, thank you so much for your time.
You're very welcome. Thanks for having me.
That was Michelle Halsell, Managing Director of the Applied Sustainability Center of the Sam M. Walton College of Business at the University of Arkansas. I spoke with her inside the Carver Center for Public Radio late last week. For more, you can visit asc.uark.edu.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Next time on Here and Now, revenues from recreational pot are flowing into Colorado coffers. Marijuana activists are now looking for legalization in other states.
There's absolutely no excuse for forcing sales into an underground market and arresting hundreds of thousands of people each year for simply possessing it.
That's next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
Here and Now begins at 1 after Ozarks at Large.
Rachel DeLue, an associate professor in the Princeton Department of Art and Archaeology, says there really isn't such a thing as Southern art history.
Our field dates to around 1830, although it really came of age in the 1960s and 70s. And when it came of age, there was no real consideration of art in the South. The folks writing about it, the collections that were being written about were based in the Northeast. And so American art history has been a history of New York and New England. So there has always been a possibility of a Southern art history. There are exhibitions here and there, publications here and there, but there aren't scholars working in a sustained fashion on the art of the South.
We'll have more coming up in about 13 minutes on Ozarks at Large.
Financial figures for several Arkansas-based companies were released last week, and the Arkansas House of Representatives continued to wrestle over the private option. Roby Brock from our content partner Talk Business Arkansas has his usual Monday roundup of the previous 7 days' events in business and politics.
Sales slipped and profits fell as Dillard's reported its fourth quarter and full year earnings. The Little Rock-based retailer reported fourth quarter net income of $119 million on sales of more than $2 billion. For the full year, Dillard's recorded $323 million of profits on lower sales of $6.7 billion. In its last fiscal year, Dillard's posted $336 million of profits on revenue of $6.75 billion. Little Rock-based Windstream posted 2013 fourth quarter earnings of $118 million, a huge improvement from $10 million 1 year ago. Revenues for the quarter ended December 31st were $1.49 billion, down 3%. For the full year, Windstream reported net income of $241 million on revenue of nearly $6 billion, compared to a $168 million profit on revenue and sales of $6.14 billion 1 year ago. Deltic Timber posted slightly lower fourth quarter earnings, but the El Dorado-based timber and real estate company scored big with full-year net income, more than doubling its previous year's profits. For the full year, Deltic's profits topped $26 million, up from $9.2 million in 2012. Revenues climbed higher by 33%. Roadrunner Transportation Systems acquired Little Rock-based Rich Logistics. In addition, Roadrunner acquired Everett Transportation, a contractor working exclusively for Rich Logistics. The total value of the transaction was approximately $48 million. Rich Logistics transports products throughout the U.S. and Mexico, utilizing a combination of independent contractors and employee drivers. In politics, Mike Ross draws a surprise primary opponent. First major surprise of the 2014 candidate filing season arose when Dr. Lynette Bryant filed paperwork to challenge Mike Ross for the Democratic nomination for governor on Friday. Bryant, who lives in Little Rock, said she did not provide advance plans of her intentions to Democratic Party leaders because she figured they'd try to talk her out of running. And finally, from the state legislature, still two votes shy of a supermajority in the Arkansas House, Speaker Davey Carter says he is unsure of what potential change may secure the additional votes that are needed to pass the private option. Carter said that limiting the enrollment period for people to sign up for the subsidized health insurance offerings may not be the breakthrough solution. In week one of the 2014 fiscal session, Carter managed to secure 73 votes for funding the private option, which has already cleared the state Senate. The funding bill needs 75 votes to gain passage in the House. Last week, Carter called off daily votes on the bill in order to find a solution from any of the 27 House members opposing the private option. I'm Roby Brock, and that is your Talk Business and Politics update.
Support for Talk Business Arkansas on Ozarks at Large is provided by AT&T, encouraging drivers to take the pledge to never text and drive. No text is worth the risk. More information at itcanwait.com. It is Monday, March 3rd, 2014, and this is Ozarks at Large. I'm Antoinette Grajeda, and joining me now is Becca Martin-Brown, Features Editor at Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
We kind of have a theme for this week.
We do.
We have art today.
Okay.
We have music tomorrow.
Okay.
We have history on Wednesday.
Uh-huh.
And we have theater on Thursday.
I like it.
So,
let's start with art.
Mm-hmm. Celebrate Art opens on Friday. No, Wednesday, I'm sorry, at the Art Center of the Ozarks in Springdale.
I know this is one of your favorites.
It is one of the most fun shows. It's 15 years in the making and features art by children from kindergarten through eighth grade. And you'd be amazed at their prowess.
Mm-hmm.
You'd be amazed at their insight.
Mm-hmm.
And some of them are just aren't cute. There's a reception to honor them from 1 to 3 on March 15th, and you can find out more at artcenteroftheozarks.org. Dayton Castleman has taken his exhibit about Coin Harvey on the road.
Mm-hmm.
He was at ACO earlier last year and will be at the Fort Smith Regional Art Museum starting March 7th.
Yep, and we'll have a story with him on tomorrow's edition of Ozarks
at Large. Fascinating.
Mm-hmm.
Fascinating. The opening reception is Thursday from 5 to 7, and the show is up through May 25th. The Center for Art and Education in the River Valley is having its 5x5 gala. One of my favorite things at the Art Center of the Ozarks, but they do theirs differently. You get your piece of art as part of your ticket price.
Oh.
But
so I don't have to bid.
But you sort of have to compete for it.
How do I have to compete for it?
They pick a set of, you get a number on your ticket, and they pick a set of numbers, and you skitter off to the piece of art you want.
Oh.
So if you have elbows like mine, it could get really brutal.
Okay.
This happens on Saturday, March 8th at the Fort Smith Convention Center, and you can buy your ticket at 474-7767. And going on at Crystal Bridges Museum of American Art, obviously among many other things, is Born of Fire Ceramic Art in Regional Collections. This is their hometown art display cases.
Okay.
And the topic right now is regional ceramics. Should be fun. It's on through all of this year, so you have plenty of time for that one. And you can find out more at crystalbridges.org.
Thank you, Becca. Becca Martin-Brown is Features Editor at Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
From Little Rock, I'm Stephen Cook with Arkansas Songs.
It's a proven theory of all astrology that human beings cannot fly through space. If I differ, let me offer my apology. but I can prove that such is not the case.
Richard Ewing Powell was born in Mountain View, Arkansas, November 14, 1904. He learned piano at a tender age from a local man, Dick Case, for whom he was also named. Similarly, Powell also acquired the nickname Dick. The Powells also lived in Berryville before moving to Little Rock. Powell sang in church, in clubs, and in bands, like Little Rock's Peter Pan Orchestra. He dropped out of high school, but later attended Little Rock College and also worked for the telephone company. Powell's first recording was issued in 1927 by Vocalion. Interest in his singing helped him enter the movies. In 1932, he acted and sang in his musical debut, Warner Brothers' Blessed Event, but it was the musical 42nd Street that really launched him that same year. Through the 1930s, Powell sang on records, on the radio, and in the movies.
There's gotta be pork, there's gotta be beans in order to fill up and fatten the fighting marines.
The mighty marines.
But Dick Powell soon tired of the lightweight characters he played under contract at Warner Brothers. He left Warner's at the end of the decade and branched out into comedy and drama, but continued singing in the movies. In 1941, he appeared with Abbott and Costello in the Navy. Powell really turned around his wholesome crooner image, however, with his role as a tough private Dick, Philip Marlowe, in the movie Murder, My Sweet. If being pigeonholed was Powell's problem, however, he soon became just as well known as a movie tough guy. In 1945, Powell married June Allison, following divorces from his childhood sweetheart Mildred Mound and actress Joan Blondell. He began working in television in the early 1950s while his company, Four Star, produced TV hits like The Rifleman. The company was respected and profitable. Getting his first directing break from Howard Hughes in 1952, Dick Powell also began directing TV and helped the early careers of Aaron Spelling, Blake Edwards, Sam Peckinpah, and others. He continued acting, too, appearing in movies and on TV's Car 54, Where Are You?, Zane Grey Theater, his own Dick Powell Show, and others. Fans of his singing, however, were left high and dry.
The soldiers of the world can conquer you with powder and with steel. The women of the world can do the same with charm and sex appeal. A soldier must be patriotic. A woman's got to be exotic. A kiss as deadly as the cannon's roar. In fact, I fear it more than warfare. The battlefield's a rocking chair. Look out, for all is fair in love and war. Just like a bombshell from the air, a kiss can blow you up. Beware of love and war. Two arms can squeeze you senseless. You're defenseless in the dark. Two eyes, two brown or blue eyes, if they do invite you, they'll dynamite you.
Powell's last visit to Arkansas was to attend a benefit for the Little Rock Boys Club, a movie premiere of his The Redhead and the Reformer in 1950. Richard Powell Jr., Powell's son with June Allison, played his own father in the 1975 movie Day of the Locust. Dick Powell died of cancer January 2, 1963, an influential star of radio, records, TV, and movies, and a millionaire. Powell was awarded a posthumous Emmy later that year. He is buried in Glendale, California. Powell's cancer was an early link to rumors that filming of The Conquerors, which he directed near an atomic test site in Utah, caused cancer among the crew. Stars John Wayne, Agnes Moorehead, and Susan Hayward also died of cancer. In the 1990s, Mountain View hosted a Dick Powell Music and Film Festival, and Powell's home, currently a flea market, received a historical marker. Here in its entirety is I'm Like a Fish Out of Water by Mountain View native Dick Powell.
Everybody says I'm witty. I can't even please my boss. I took Pelmanism to give me magnetism, so I could put myself across. And so it really seems a pity you put me at a total loss. I'm like a fish out of water when I'm with you, as helpless as Morgan swinging it on the organ, or Mae West playing an ingenue. Every time that I'm with you, I'm like a fish out of water when you're around. I'm like Eddie Cantor doing a Van de Vanter or Charles E. Lindbergh upon the ground. Whenever you're around, I feel so small and I get red as a bee. I trip and fall, I'm all hands and feet. I'm quite a card and a cut-up around the boys, but you make me shut up and lose my poise. It's a funny thing what love can do. I'm like a fish out of water with you. And I get red as a bee. I trip and fall, I'm all hands and feet. I'm quite a card and a cut up around the boys, but you make me shut up and lose my poise. It's a funny thing what love can do. I'm like a fish out of water with you.
Dick Powell of Mountain View, Berryville, and Little Rock with I'm Like a Fish Out of Water. It's another song of Arkansas. From Little Rock, I'm Stephen Cook with Arkansongs.
Arkansongs is a production of FM 89 and Experiment Station Studios. For more information, visit arkansongs.org.
This is Ozarks at Large. Art may be in the eye of the beholder, but comprehension of a work of art can become greater the more information you have. Rachel DeLue spends much of her time finding out more about art and then sharing her knowledge. She's an associate professor in the Princeton Department of Art and Archaeology, and late last month she was in Northwest Arkansas to participate in the annual meeting of the Southern Intellectual History Circle, which came to Arkansas for the first time ever. Rachel DeLue has written several books on art, including studies of the landscape artist George Ennis and American abstract painter Arthur Dove. She spoke on the University of Arkansas campus and at Crystal Bridges during her visit in February, and she also came to the Carver Center for Public Radio to talk to me about art, appreciation, and the topic of one of her talks while here, the problem and promise of a Southern art history.
There isn't really such a thing as Southern art history at present. Our field dates to around 1830, although it really came of age in the 1960s and 70s. And when it came of age, there was no real consideration of art in the South. The folks writing about it, the collections that were being written about were based in the Northeast. And so American art history has been a history of New York and New England. So there has always been a possibility of a Southern art history. There are exhibitions here and there, publications here and there, but there aren't scholars working in a sustained fashion on the art of the South. So there's a real possibility to look at this material and incorporate it into larger histories of American art. But there are also problems associated with that. And those problems have very much to do with the idea of the Southern as a category.
Exactly, yeah. What does that mean?
Well, that's the question. What does Southern mean? Is it geographical? Is it cultural? Is it historical? Is an artist who is born in the South Southern, even though he or she works in New York City? Is art with Southern subject matter considered Southern art? The question is, how does one define it? So in order to produce a Southern art history, one has to figure out what one's objects of inquiry are. And the problem with the category of Southern is that it can circumscribe a field incorrectly or ahistorically, by which I mean it can include people who might not belong or exclude folks who really demand to be understood as Southern artists. And again, it's a question of, in a sense, segregating a whole cohort of makers who, of course, have relationships to the so-called North and to Europe and to the rest of the world. So to pigeonhole those folks as Southern artists in a way that we don't do with other artists. You would never call the 19th century American landscape painter Thomas Cole a Northern landscape painter. So those are some of the perils or problems associated with the question.
Well, then just getting the definition sounds difficult. It's almost as if before you can start the serious scholarship in that category, just how will we define it? And can you?
Absolutely. I think the answer to the question, can you define it, is resoundingly no. but I think there is value in making the effort, if only because there is a huge history of art, a widespread range of artistic practices characteristic of, or at least located in the South, that haven't been attended to by scholars of American art history. And so our sense of the field is a pretty narrow one, given that.
And it's interesting because in music, the public can identify, if you say Southern music, there's Cajun, there's Hank Williams, there's... But if you ask most of us in the public Southern art, most of us, I think, when we walk into a museum and we're viewing something, we may know Thomas Hart Benton is from Kansas City, but most of what we see, we don't know where they're from.
No.
And there may not be anything on that canvas that indicates, oh, this is a lap steel, in other words.
That's exactly right. And so the question is, does the subject matter need to be recognizably Southern? And I think scholars of the South have tended to focus on writing because writers in the South, Faulkner, Welty, et cetera, write about the South. But artists in the South don't necessarily make art about the South. And the question is, does an abstract painting with absolutely no reference to anything Southern count as Southern art? Some would say yes, some would say no. And so it is exactly the problem of definition that has, I think, prevented, for good reason, a wholesale jump into the notion of a Southern art history.
Yeah. If there are some of us who want to think about Southern art, are we just shortchanging the whole idea of scholarship by trying to put the definition on? Should we just think about art?
I think so. I mean, I think there... The question is very similar to the question one would ask about African American art. And so the category African American art assumes that African American art exists in relation to, say, American art. And so American art, which might be defined as art by European descended or white people, is the norm, and African American art is a category that sits next to it. And that means that when we say we talk about an African American artist or we make an exhibition of African American art, we are demanding that those artists be seen in terms of their identity, which means that the art part of the work might be ignored or left out or given short shrift. The same goes for Southern art. If we choose the lens of the South or Southernness through which to look at this art, we may not see certain things about that art that are absolutely important, that the artist wanted to be there. The artist may not want the art to be understood as Southern in the same way that an African American artist might not want his or her art to be understood as African American in content.
The conversation we're having and the papers and conversations you have at conferences, whether it's at Crystal Bridges, whether you've gone to Russia to talk about Cezanne, these are conversations that don't happen for most people when they're in a museum. I'd say, I'm going to pull out a number, 95-98% of people who go through and appreciate art aren't thinking about it like this. What would you like those of us who are not art scholars to think about, or is that even something you think about, when we're looking at art?
Well, I think first and foremost, I would like any visitor, including myself and my students, to spend some time simply looking at a work of art without being preconditioned by information, wall labels, textual description. But then I want that visitor to have access to information about the subject matter of the work, about the biography of the artist. I would like there to be information about how scholars have described and understood these works of art. So I imagine in various venues, texts, wall labels, audio guides, digital apps, the visitor having access to exactly what information he or she might want in order to illuminate the work of art. But I think that any visitor should be able to know as much as I do about a work of art and then can choose how to understand that work of art. I really feel that there's a fine line between dictating what the visitor understands about a work of art and letting the visitor experience that work of art himself or herself. But I do think that most people who don't have expertise in the field of art history can feel somewhat lost in a museum, simply because he or she doesn't necessarily know why and isn't told why what's on view is important and why he or she should be looking at that stuff. So even the simple gesture of saying, this is important because, or we chose to put it on the wall because, can really help the viewer develop a relationship, a substantial relationship to what he or she is seeing.
And the context. I mean, there are so many paintings from previous centuries where, when I hear the description and the symbolism, they were almost editorial cartoons. People at the time knew what was being... And when you get that information, you can appreciate it
absolutely
more.
Yeah. So one thing that artists did in the 19th century for their viewers was offer what I would call a key. So artists would actually make a key, so sketch the painting in outline form and label it and decode it for the viewer. And these pamphlets would circulate for viewers, so viewers would have access to what the artist's intentions and what these hidden symbolisms were all about. I would love to do that for viewers in museums. I mean, genre painting, which refers to painting of everyday life in the 1830s and 1840s, is full of colloquial references and allusions to vernacular speech, ways of speaking that we have no access to today. And that kind of painting can't be understood unless somebody is made to understand that there are jokes and plays on words happening in the picture. So even something as simple as a key would really help, I think, in the museum context.
You've been a consultant to museums and collections. When you're a consultant, how does that work? Do they say, would this work with the collection, or do we have a gaping hole here that would help tell the story?
I think acquisitions is part of it. So museums have collections and are always wanting to build those collections. And the first question any museum asks, and this is the question that I'm asked to think about, is how can we best tell the story of the history of American art? And I'm often brought in to advise the museum about how to tell the story. Well, you have a lot of work by artists from the Northeast. How about work from other regions, the Midwest, the South, the Far West? And that's a whole other question. California art is a similar possibility and problem. The other questions have to do with public programming. How can we make this art accessible to our various publics? How do we translate academic scholarship into a kind of knowledge that is accessible for the public? And how do we produce programming that will draw viewers in but also bring the art to life for those viewers? So those are some of the things that I talk about with museums. And it's been wonderful for me because as a scholar, I can find myself alone in my office thinking extremely elaborate thoughts. And when I'm forced to think about how museums speak to their publics, it reflects back on my own work and reminds me that my own work absolutely has to speak to general audiences, or why write it?
Well, you mentioned the word accessibility, and I think of art often much like poetry or classical music. People don't want to even approach it because they think they're not going to understand it.
Mm-hmm.
And you begin to lose if people won't even try
that
to see or hear the work.
That's right. So there has to be a way in. There has to be some kind of a hook. And this is something that I think about a lot as a teacher. Students come to my classes having, some of them have never been to a museum or spent time looking for an extended period at a work of art. And it's a different way of seeing. We don't walk around in our everyday lives spending 20 minutes looking meticulously at the bark of a tree. This is what we do in a museum. We spend 20 minutes looking meticulously at a painting. And so the first thing I do with my students is help them understand what that kind of looking entails and what the way of seeing of an art historian is. And that's the first step toward access, to understand that each of us does have the capacity to really look carefully and glean information from what he or she is seeing. So it's wonderful to see that leap on the part of my students from the state of, oh, I couldn't possibly say anything about this work of art, it's completely closed to me, to, oh, I get it. This is so interesting. It's like reading Moby Dick, but it's a picture. I see how I can unpack it and understand it in a similar way.
I get the idea that every time you go in a museum, you're hoping to glean something.
Yes, absolutely.
That you may not have known or...
Absolutely. I try not to go into a museum with too many preconceived notions. And I find that even the most familiar works of art, so a painting by George Innes about whom I've written, or a painting by Arthur Dove, a book on whom I've just finished, I make myself go in front of those pictures over and over again, because every time I look, I see something new. And every time I look at those paintings with my students, they show me something new. Sometimes I feel the more I look, the less I know. And so students bring their fresh eyes to the canvases and help me see things that I haven't before. And I mean, that's one of the deep satisfactions of teaching, but it's also a lesson that I take very seriously, that one can never see everything picture.
You mentioned Arthur Dove, who was a contemporary of Alfred Stieglitz.
That's right.
Crystal Bridges, of course, has this. So are you looking forward to going there and perhaps making some connections? Or?
Yes, absolutely. The Crystal Bridges has a wonderful collection of Dove work, many small-scale sketches, which are often difficult to see because they're not on view because of the condition of the object. So I'm thrilled to have the opportunity to go to Crystal Bridges and see these pictures. And one of the paintings is one that I actually haven't seen before. So this, for an art historian, this is extremely exciting.
So I don't mean to be simple, but take me through, what do you do when you, I mean, is it as simple as just walking up and looking at it?
Well, you know, I mean, at the risk of making art history as frivolous as President Obama described it as being, yes, it is. That's what I do. I walk up and I look. And I spend some time looking, and the next thing I do is actually sketch. I take out a notebook, and I could never possibly recreate any of the things that I look at. But I try. I produce a sketch and work my way through the picture by trying to render in a kind of notational form what I see. And in the same manner that I tell my students, writing is a form of knowing. As you write, illumination happens. The notating of the picture makes me look at it really, really closely and makes me see things that I might not have had I just been looking without doing the drawing exercise. And this is something that, and maybe it's because I'm a scholar of the 19th and early 20th century, but this practice dates to the 19th century. Students of studio art were told to draw, to go out into nature and draw so as to know it better. So for me, looking but also notating, I feel, gets me into the picture and helps me imagine what it would have been like for the artist in his or her studio to be painting it and to be making the decisions, the choices that went into the finished product.
Rachel DeLue is an associate professor in the Princeton Department of Art and Archaeology. She talked to me late last month while she was in Northwest Arkansas to participate in the annual meeting of the Southern Intellectual History Circle. The group met in Arkansas for the first time ever late last month. Rachel DeLue is the author of several books, including George Innes and The Science of Landscape.
Friday afternoon, more than 450 students from school districts in 15 different counties in Arkansas brought their science projects to the University of Arkansas. The Northwest Arkansas Regional Science and Engineering Fair was judged by faculty members at the U of A and graduate students. Projects were created by students from 5th through 12th grades and included topics such as research to determine if kittens have a dominant paw, that is, if they're left pawed or right pawed, to the effect of caffeine on the human heart rate. Students put up their projects inside the student union, then left to allow for judging. Just before the science students from Kingston, Arkansas left, their science teacher Phil Collins and Principal Marcia Shaver spoke briefly about the preparation their students had for the science fair.
We had 15 participants, and I suppose we had 15 projects.
Well, it starts with an idea, curiosity, and then it takes a lot of focus and a lot of hard work. So that's what we're trying to do, is teach them how to problem solve and get them ready for college and then beyond.
We start thinking about it early in the school year, August, September, and we work on it till the end.
Yeah, I mean, we're at a point now where the kids need to try to develop their own, and we're just there as an advisor, and we try to guide them in the right direction. We try to get them to focus and see it through to the end. So we're there mainly for support these days. Well, mine did, they were in 6 or 7 different categories. So for chemistry, we had one that did spectrophotometric analysis of aspirin to see if you were getting the bang for your buck, if there was enough milligrams in for the extra strength aspirin. We had one young lady that did one to see if steel was appropriate for bridge building. And she used analysis as well through spectrophotometry. So they were pretty detailed.
Very, very important. With a small community, any award or accomplishment the kids get, it's a big deal for the community.
The Northwest Arkansas Regional Science and Engineering Fair was held Friday afternoon on the University of Arkansas campus. Senior division winners advanced to the State Science and Engineering Fair in Conway this spring.
Jazz is in the air every Friday and Saturday evening from 10 p.m. till 1 a.m. right here on KUAF 91.3 FM. From 10 to midnight, it's Shades of Jazz with yours truly, Robert Ginsberg. Daniel Estes takes you from midnight till 1 a.m. on Saturday morning with Goodnight Jazz, and it's Fred Hall's Swing Thing at midnight on Sundays. America's Music, Jazz, on your NPR station KUAF.
And before we end this edition of Ozarks at Large, a preview of tomorrow's all-new edition of Ozarks at Large. We'll have a conversation with Jim DePriest. He's a deputy attorney general with the state of Arkansas. He'll be in Fayetteville on Sunday to talk about fraud, specifically fraud aimed at seniors.
We find that one reason why they may be reluctant to come forward and report that they've been scammed and ask for assistance in getting their money back is that they fear losing their independence. If you're in your 70s or 80s and you report getting taken, then maybe, you know, that's a suggestion that you're not as competent as you used to be. It's something, of course, every senior citizen wants to maintain their independence, and they have a full life of experiences, so they're actually pretty sharp consumers overall, but they don't want to appear to be losing their faculties, and that may make them reluctant to come forward.
Jim DePriest, a deputy attorney general with the state of Arkansas, on tomorrow's edition of Ozarks at Large. And this is KUAF 91.3 FM, Fayetteville, Fort Smith, Bentonville, Siloam Springs. I'm Kyle Kellums for my colleague Antoinette Grajeda. Thanks so much for listening to our program today. We'll be back tomorrow at noon with an all-new edition of Ozarks at Large. Ozarks at Large, a production of KUAF.